May it please the court, my name is Robert Robinson. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Jordan Williams. Before the court today is a single issue, and that is whether or not the trial judge properly denied Mr. Williams' motion to suppress certain evidence that was seized as the result of what we contend was an improper detention and also an improper questioning. My argument consists of two parts. First, was Jordan Williams seized when Officer Brittingham of the Georgetown Police Department approached him that night? And then in the alternative, if this court concludes that he was not seized, I intend to argue that the line of questioning that the officer engaged in was not permitted because of 1902 of Title 11 of the Delaware Code. The first issue, the seizure question, I concede is a fairly close question. However, I think if the court examines the totality of the circumstances as established at with the facts at the suppression hearing, I think the court will find that no reasonable person was free to ignore the police presence that night. Obviously, the state is going to point to factors such as the fact that there was no pat down, there were no verbal commands to stop, there were no flashing lights of the police car. However, I think that the pertinent facts that support a seizure include that this was a uniformed officer. This was a marked patrol car. The officer made a U-turn specifically to approach Mr. Williams. The officer was driving down the highway when he spotted Mr. Williams. He did a U-turn. Mr. Williams was the only person out on the road, and in fact, I think the officer testified that he was probably the only car out on the road that night. So it was clear from his stop and his U-turn that he was there specifically to confront Mr. Williams.
Is there anything to the fact that the brief recites that he turned on his strobe lights?
I think that that is also a factor. I also think it's important that the officer exited his vehicle and was only several feet away from Mr. Williams. I think typically the courts have looked for the overhead lights to be flashing, but I think that the strobe lights would certainly give the appearance to a reasonable person that this was an actual stop.
Now, strobe lights, are they in the grill, or is that something?
I believe at the suppression hearing it was ascertained that those are usually typically located in the rear of the vehicle. I think the officer testified that those were primarily to let cars that were proceeding down the highway see that his car was out there in the median strip.
And how was the car positioned in terms of Mr. Williams?
I believe the officer, the way he described it, was that Mr. Williams was at that time in the process of crossing the highway. He was stopped when the officer saw him. He was in the median strip of the highway, so he was crossing. The officer testified that he turned into a turn lane and that was actually located behind Mr. Williams in his path of progress.
So is there evidence that Williams could see the strobe lights or not?
I don't believe that there was any evidence to that effect one way or the other. I do think, though, that the way the car was positioned basically perpendicular to the two highway travel lanes, I think that Mr. Williams would have seen those. Either way, though, I think that it was clear to Mr. Williams that Officer Brittingham was there to speak directly to him, and that is why he felt compelled to stop and turn around and answer Mr. Williams or answer the police officer's questions.
Is it correct that you conceded, or the defendant conceded at the suppression hearing, that the initial contact to offer assistance was appropriate?
That is correct. That we did concede that. I think in hindsight, and after reviewing some of the community caretaker cases a little bit more closely, and it appears that there are only three, I think, in Delaware currently. This may not have risen to the level of peril or distress or obvious need of assistance that might support that, but we did concede that down at the court below, that this initial confrontation at least would have been excused by the community caretaker standard, or that it was a reasonable stop. I'm not sure exactly which standard the Delaware courts follow. I don't think that that's been determined yet. But either way, whether it was reasonable or whether the stop was excused, when the officer asked Mr. Williams if he needed assistance, and Mr. Williams declined that offer, and then during that time of the confrontation between the officer and Mr. Williams gave no other cause of alarm to the officer to think that Mr. Williams was engaged in any kind of criminal activity, that that community caretaker exception to the seizure rule would have terminated or extinguished, and that the officer had no reason to ask any further questions. That those questions that he asked of Mr. Williams, your name and your birth date, those were not in any way related to the original purpose of the stop, which was just to offer Mr. Williams a ride.
Are you making your argument as a matter of federal law and Delaware law, or simply Delaware law?
Well, it's my understanding that Delaware law offers greater protections through primarily the Jones case, so that would be primarily, I think, where I would be starting the argument with the seizure.
But are you arguing that as a matter of federal law, there's a problem with a police officer asking for your name and date of birth in connection with an otherwise valid stop?
I have raised both claims on appeal. I think that the state claim is probably stronger than the federal claim.
All right. You didn't really answer my question. Are you saying that you believe the federal law, under federal law, there's a problem with asking a person for their name and date of birth in connection with an otherwise valid stop, even if that's not the purpose of the stop?
I think that's probably the case that the under federal law, if there is a stop, I think that's the Mania case that raises that issue. I think the facts in that case were very different than the facts that we have here. I have not really been able to find a federal case that I think was on point with this particular fact pattern. I think the federal cases do make it clear that during an otherwise valid stop, that you are permitted to ask certain questions if those are related to the stop.
What about if they're not related to the stop as a matter of federal law?
Those would probably, I think it really just depends on the circumstances of the case. And I think the reasons for asking the circumstances in the Mania case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, you know, this was a situation where the person was handcuffed during a search warrant of her house. It took several hours, and that during that time, the immigration officials questioned her with some of those questions, and the court deemed that to be appropriate. But I think in those situations, that's a very different situation than what we have here.
I'm looking at your opening brief. I don't see that case from the United States Supreme Court cited in your brief, and I don't see the Jones case cited in your brief. Putting that aside, and my question is, aren't you really limited to either a federal argument or a statutory argument? Because we said in Ortiz, if you don't brief and argue a state constitutional issue, it's waived on appeal. And the only reference to the state constitution is on page one of your brief, where you simply note that there's a section in the Delaware Constitution.
I believe that issue was also raised. I think I also raised the state constitutional issue in my motion. I think that the issues were...
But the rule is on appeal.
Okay.
You have to present your argument fully and fairly in your opening brief. And in Ortiz, we said specifically, a full and fair presentation requires analysis and citation to supporting authority. Okay. And my question is, in the absence of either analysis or citation to supporting authority with regard to the state constitution, that's waived. So now you're back to just a federal argument or a statutory construction argument, is that correct?
I suppose so. I mean, I would have to defer to the court if that's the court's position.
Well, no, that's what we've held in other cases. If you know of a reason why that doesn't apply to your brief, now's the time to tell us.
Right. I think that those issues were fairly raised to the court about the circumstances.
Well, they might have been raised to the Superior Court. But the fact that they were raised doesn't mean they were preserved for appeal in the absence of you briefing and arguing them in your opening brief. That's the problem, not that they weren't raised at the Superior Court. The question is, have they been fully, has a state constitutional argument been fully and fairly presented to this court in this case in your opening brief?
Well, I would submit that the my discussion of the Meads case brought those types of questions in through my discussion of the Meads case, which was a state Superior Court case. I agree that possibly I should have analyzed it much more closely, but I think to the extent that the purpose is to put the state on notice of what the claim is, I think the state's answering brief did take those issues that I raised, and I think that the issues are similar enough between the state and the federal issues that those could be kind of combined, I guess.
Well, turning back for a moment to the federal constitution, are there any cases that speak to a circumstance where the initial contact here, 3:50 in the morning, pulling the car up to the individual, no problem, as your brief suggests, with the initial contact? Is there any federal case that says there's a constitutional problem arising out of asking for basic information such as the name and an age, even if the officer's sole purpose in asking for that information is to go back to his car, do a computer search of whether there are any outstanding warrants for that individual? Is there any federal case that speaks to that scenario?
Not that I was able to locate in preparation for this particular issue.
Right. How about 1902? Does our section 1902 have any bearing on this contact
in well,
later and, events?
And I think, as the court is aware from my brief and the argument the last time, I think the 1902 is the particularly interesting argument in this case. I think that even if the court finds that Mr. Williams was not seized, I think that we still have a 1902 issue, because 1902 specifically articulates the various questions such as name, address, business abroad, and that's where I think the real interesting part of this argument is. This is a situation. I did have the benefit of hearing the state's argument in the Meads case, which raised a similar issue, similar 1902 issue to this court. This court decided not to rule on the 1902 issue because you decided that it wasn't fairly presented to the trial court below. But listening to that argument, it was clear that the state seems to be taking the position that I'm somehow arguing that 1902, if you ask the names, that's automatically some type of seizure. I think that what I'm arguing in this case is a little bit different, in that I think that you need to have some reason to get to those types of questions. I think there's a big difference between the friendly neighborhood policing, kind of hi, what's your name type question, versus give me your name, your address, your birthday, because I'm going to run your information through the computer, and there's a good chance I might arrest you if I find anything. I think that those things are problematic.
Well, Mr. Robinson, that's what I wanted to explore, at least as a matter of statutory construction. And your argument appears to proceed from the language of 1902, and it runs like this. There was no evidence that this defendant was committing a crime or about to commit a crime or had committed a crime. Therefore, you conclude under the statute the police officer could not ask him the questions that the statute would otherwise permit. My problem is, let's assume you're right. What follows from that? That is, does the statute occupy the field such that that we must draw a negative inference that if it doesn't apply, that these questions cannot be asked under any circumstances? Or is the statute simply in addition to whatever common law basis the police might otherwise have apart from the statute to ask those questions?
Well, that's why I think that this is such an interesting issue. 1902 has been around since, as best I can tell, from about June of 1951 in some form or another when it was passed as part of the Uniform Arrest Act. So it certainly predates Terry. I would argue that in the state of Delaware anyway, that 1902 should be given great independent importance and not just
But what kind of independent importance? The statute might be viewed as simply articulating or codifying a portion of the common law, but without exhausting all of the common law.
No, and I think that it would be unreasonable to take a position that the second that a police officer asks someone their name or any other type of identifying information, that that's a seizure. I think that if you look at the circumstances of that question,
let's put seizure to one side.
Okay. If you look at the circumstances surrounding that questioning, what the police officer does with that information, and these can all be ascertained through objective facts. And I think it's important in this case that the officer, while he testifies that he asked this name just because he was curious about any possible problems that might come up in the future, he didn't just write the name down on a scrap of paper and save it till the end of the shift. He ran the name through the computer.
I'm not sure that you're grasping the problem. Maybe I should try to rephrase it. Your argument is that the statute, the conditions of the statute haven't been met. That is, there was no evidence that this gentleman was either about to commit a crime or had committed a crime or was committing a crime. Therefore, you conclude, under 1902, the police officer cannot question this defendant, can't ask him his name, can't ask him his address or date of birth. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That argument presupposes that the statute is the sole source of authority for the officer to do that. And whether it is or it isn't is the problem that at least I have.
I see.
If the statute is intended to be the sole source of authority, that is to occupy the field, then it would your argument would have that basis on which to rest statutorily. But if the statute is only declaratory of the common law, and there's some other source of common law that under which the police could find authority to ask the questions, even if 1902 doesn't apply, then we have a different case. And so the question I ask you is, and it's not clear from your opponent's brief what his position is either, where does 1902 fit into the broad scheme of the legal authority for the police to ask these types of questions?
I think that 1902, I don't think it's unusual for state law or state constitution to offer greater protection than what may be provided for in the federal law. I think that 1902 would offer a citizen greater protections from those four articulated questions in 1902, and that I think that that's a separate question that is fair to be raised in a suppression.
But that would apply to your community police officer. Officer Krumke walks up to someone and says, "Hi, I'm Officer Krumke. What's your name?" Is it your argument that 1902 renders that question illegal?
In that particular circumstance, that would not be my argument. Now, if that officer said, "Hi, I'm Officer Krumke. What's your name? What's your address?" and then uses that information to do an investigation on that person, I think that that would be problematic. I think the situation that we have
depends on the purpose in asking.
I know that it's important to stay away from any type of subjective questioning of what might be going on in the police officer's mind, but I think that you can look at whatever objective facts arise that the police officer used that information for. In this case, the officer went and ran that information through the computer and use that to do an investigation of Mr. Williams. This was basically a fishing expedition on the part of the police officer. And you have a situation here where Mr. Williams, and I think that's what's so interesting about this case, is that Mr. Williams is literally walking down the street minding his own business. He's not engaged in any obvious criminal activity. He's not any obvious violation of statutes or ordinances that the police officer either knew about or cared about. This is literally a guy walking down the street, doing nothing suspicious, not in a high crime area, and yet the police officer, through kind of an interesting chain of events, determines that he has these gate pieces out for him, takes him into custody, and during that time finds the weapon on him, which is what he was found guilty of.
Can I follow up on Justice Jacobs' question, which I wasn't sure there was an answer for? Is it your position that Section 1902 preempts the field? That basic, and to put it another way, that if we find that conduct was in violation of or not permitted by Section 1902, that must be the end of our analysis. We cannot then look to see whether under any other law that would also operate in these circumstances, it was permissible.
I think that when you get to those specific questions articulated in 1902, that and those questions come up, that should be the end of the inquiry. If there are further bases, I think that the court then can look into that, whether there are other grounds for a police officer to make that type of stop.
Well, then we don't get to 1902 at all because those four questions weren't asked. Only two were asked, correct?
I don't think it's a and thing. I think it's a any of those questions.
Well, then I misunderstood what you just said. I thought you said if the police officer wants to ask the four questions under 1902 and does, then he must have had to have a reasonable suspicion before he detained the person for up to 2 hours for the purpose of asking those questions.
Right.
But here we don't have that. We have a police officer who sees someone at 3:50 in the morning. It's very cold outside. He makes an inquiry basically about, are you okay? What's your name and what's your age or address? I forget now which it was. Now, looking at that without the suspicion that he wanted to then run the names, we look at that objectively, and the simple question I have is, what's wrong with that? Why is that improper?
Well, I think that has placed a citizen in a position where they don't feel comfortable ignoring the police presence and walking away with that and basically giving the police officer information that officer is going to use as the basis of arresting Mr. Williams. I think that that's where the concern is. I think that
it's correct, they don't have to respond, right?
Well, I think that if you look at subsection B of 1902, which reads that any person so questioned who fails to give identification or explain the person's actions to the satisfaction of the officer may be detained. I think that the state's position that the stop in subsection A really means detention or seizure would render the use of the word detain in subsection B would render that moot or meaningless.
But we all agree there's no reason to suspect he's committing a crime, which is the linchpin for 1902 to apply
right.
In the first place. So maybe I'm simply asking the same question Justice Jacobs and Justice Berger have asked differently. But in the absence of any concern about suspicion of criminal activity and the police officer, given these circumstances, cold, 3:50 in the morning, somebody in the median of a traveled roadway, simply asks the person, are you okay? What's your name and what's your address or age? What's wrong with that? Why is that improper?
Well, I think when you run the first question together with the second and third question, you know, that is, I think, problematic. I mean, the officer had no reason to ask those types of questions. Those questions were not related to the offer of assistance. Those were purely a fishing expedition to try to find something that possibly he could arrest Mr. Williams for.
If we look at it objectively and don't look at it subjectively, that the officer's purpose was to get that information in order to run him through the computer and possibly arrest him for something that is totally unrelated to stopping him in the first place, fine. But looking at it objectively, is it irrational or improper for the police officer to simply ask him his name and his age or address?
I think that that's improper.
Why? Tell me why.
Because that's
what bars it? What statute, what principle of law, what constitutional provision bars it?
Well, I think that in that type of situation, a citizen is not going to feel free to not answer the police officer's questions. And I don't see really any difference between that and a police officer standing on a street corner and as people walking by, ask them their name and their address and their birth date, taking that information and using it for whatever purpose he wants to. When we look at things like DUI checkpoint cases, those are very brief detentions, but those are situations where the courts have said we need a carefully circumscribed set of policies that would govern even these very brief, very non-intrusive detentions. And yet the courts have repeatedly said that those need to be very carefully monitored so that there are no abuses in that case.
Is there also an administrative purpose for obtaining the name?
Does the officer
have to write a report as to what he did?
I don't think that was established down below. I don't think that there was any report that would have been forthcoming from the officer if the issue about the gun hadn't come up. And it was actually related to the checkpoint.
So there's no evidence of a of a police contact or individual contact or community caretaker stop, that the police would have to disclose that to their superiors?
There was nothing presented at the suppression hearing about that below, and I don't think that I think the officer testified that he would get the name and run it through the computer as a matter of policy, but he never said anything about recording the name or generating a report because of that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, my name is Paul Wallace. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, the State of Delaware, in this matter. I think, knowing I'll get the question, I'd like to turn to the question that three of the justices have asked, at least in various forms. 1902 is an adjunct. It is an adjunct to certain constitutional principles, but basically what it does is it gives the police officers, when they have actually seized someone, when they have a reasonable articulable suspicion, the ability to demand certain things. The language of the statute is clear. It says they may, in those circumstances, may demand that information, and then has, for lack of a better term, punishment, but an enforcement aspect to it, and B, by saying, and if they don't, if they have this reasonable articulable suspicion to believe that the person has committed an offense or is about to commit an offense, if they haven't given this information, it gives the police officer the ability to, in fact, take the person into detention for a short period of time to try to straighten the matter out. What it doesn't do is it doesn't say, only in these circumstances may the police ever ask for that information. And that's the real problem in this case. And Mr. Robinson listened to Meads. This court heard Meads. I think that's been somewhat of a difficult situation for the superior court or the lower courts to deal with in trying to understand when we have what are community caretaker interactions between police officers or non-seizures and actual law enforcement seizures. The state suggests respectfully, and the defendant in this case, the appellant in this case, actually conceded below, the initial stop, the initial, and I don't want to say stop because that continues to get us into that second category of law enforcement, but the initial interaction, the initial encounter was appropriate.
Well, wait a second. I'm not really challenging whether the initial interaction was appropriate. In fact, it's been conceded, but even if it weren't conceded, you seem to be suggesting that if what the police do when they approach somebody is they want to find out if this person's in need of help, assistance, that if that's the reason for their approaching somebody, then it is not a stop, and therefore other constitutional protections don't come into play. Why isn't the nature of the encounter, because I don't want to use one of the wrong words here, but why isn't it the nature of the encounter, not the purpose of it, that determines whether there has been a constitutionally protected stop? And then we look to see, okay, well, the reason why this person was seized or stopped was for a reason that is considered acceptable, namely to do your caretaker function where you had a basis to believe this person needed help. Another reason could be that you had a reasonable articulable suspicion of criminal activity. That also would justify a stop. But you don't determine whether it was a stop or not by what the purpose of it was. You determine it by the standards that, you know, we've articulated in terms of whether a reasonable person would feel free to ignore the police presence and continue on his way.
I remember the panel argument in this, and I remember Justice Ridgely asked a similar question about the fact that that's something that state courts grapple with, and the federal courts have grappled with, and that is, what is this animal of a community caretaker encounter? Is it really something that implicates the Fourth Amendment? Is it a seizure that's excused, or is it simply not a seizure or a stop? The state suggests the latter, and the reason is this, because you can look at the objective facts of what occurred and determine that it either falls into that Fourth Amendment realm, that law enforcement realm, that seizure, arrest, questioning, detention, whatever you want to call it, or it goes to what the other things that police officers do. And some of the law review articles and some of the various state court opinions talk about this. And that's law enforcement.
Help us understand the facts in this case as I read them. He said, I stopped to see if he was okay because he's in the media and it's almost 4 o'clock in the morning. And then when he asked, why did you inquire about his name and age, he said, well, when we have contact with people, we like to note the contact in case they come to some harm later or there's, you know, we discover them hurt or injured. We know that we had contact with them. But in this case, he didn't wait for some report that the person had been injured or come to some harm. He used the information to do this check that led to the second inquiry. So if we're going to somehow look at community policing contacts differently, why shouldn't the scope of what's permissible be limited by the nature of that different type of contact?
Well, I would suggest, respectfully, Your Honor, that even the police officer's activity in this case, first the questioning about what's your name, when, what's your age or date of birth, however he had asked it, and that those were the two questions he asked. Remember, this is a 21-year-old young man out there at 3:50 in the
later that he asked those questions because it was routine when you had these community contacts,
right,
to make note of who you encountered in case they came to harm later on.
Right, and to do that, a police officer, let's
but
take the worst
did
case.
Did he say that's why he asked for the name and age?
He did, and in fact, specifically, and this is in the appellant's appendix, we usually, when asked, why did you do it? We usually do it in case anything happens to him. We have got some place, you know, we know this person. If he doesn't have any ID on him, like a check of welfare complaint, this person was contacted in this case. There was some something were to happen to him, a reference point.
And he didn't use it for that purpose in this case. So then we go back to the question, is there any limitation when you're doing one of these community encounters on the type of questions you can ask, realizing people are always free to decline?
I suggest no, and I think maybe that goes to even when you have because even the federal Constitution and Royer tells us that when you have what are basically consensual or non-investigative stops and you ask person questions, Royer, by the way, says you can ask them, it doesn't limit the type of question that's asked, it's just whether or not the person's willing to answer or not and whether you force the question upon them.
Isn't our problem here, though, that the initial contact wasn't really an investigative contact in best case scenario, and certainly as the trial judge believed it, it was a caretaker function, but it turned into an investigative stop. Once he got the information, he conducted an investigation. He did a background check, and it turned up outstanding capuses, and the guy got arrested.
That's true, Your Honor, except at that time, the defendant was already gone. In fact, he had let him go by the time he even did the check. And I'd suggest that that's in keeping with exactly, if we look at the objective facts, what the police officer said he was doing. That is, we do check. We do ask for names, and we do it to get a reference point.
Well, maybe I missed something, but what the police officer said he was doing and what the police officer actually did were two dramatically different things. He didn't just log in a contact that I contacted Mr. Williams at 3:50 in the morning. It was very cold. I was concerned about him. He says he was okay. I saw no independent evidence that he was not. Therefore, I left him alone. I have performed my Good Samaritan caretaker function. Make a note of it on a piece of paper, type it into his in-house computer, or write it down when he got back to the troop or the police station. That's not what he did. He took that information and turned it into an investigative tool, which raises the issue, was that what he had in mind the whole time?
Except if that is what he had in mind at the whole time, Your Honor, he would have never let him go then. He would have asked him or demanded the information there and said, wait here while I check on you. What I suggest is it's not two dramatically different things. They have an in-house computer. He's just gotten this information from a person at 3:50 in the morning, And the person says, I'm Jordan Williams, I'm 21 years old, or whatever he told him his date of birth. The first thing he may want to go back is check and ensure that that's correct, so that if, in fact, he does have to log it and okay. do the things you're going to do with community caretaker, correct.
Let me put it in a real world perspective. I'm a child of the 60s. I'm still worried about police contact with people in the community for no apparent purpose other than to just interfere with their lives, or ultimately perhaps harass them. Tell me why I shouldn't be concerned as a matter of law with a police officer engaging in this kind of contact and then getting basic personal information, immediately turning to a computer for the purpose of determining whether there are any outstanding warrants, and then going back and arresting the guy. Tell me why I should be perfectly comfortable with that.
I'd suggest that the court should be comfortable with that, maybe not perfectly, but comfortable with that, because if we look at everything else he did, if in fact all he was doing was to harass him or to try to do a fishing expedition, he would have held him there. The reality is, and I'd suggest in the real world, is that police officers have different functions all the time. And in this particular case, he was carrying out that function. But once he gets that information, in the real world, if he didn't get that information and Mr. Williams shows up dead down the street, and now all of a sudden you have a Georgetown police officer who dealt with somebody at 3:50 in the morning and didn't even bother to get his name.
All right.
Or if he got a fake name,
Mr. Wallace,
and didn't check on it, he's in trouble too.
You've answered the Chief Justice's question factually, but the question was, why as a matter of law was that conduct by the police officer okay? I'm going to recharacterize the question, but I'm really basically asking the same question. I understand that the state's position is that Section 1902 doesn't apply at all in this case. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Secondly, that 1902 is not the sole source of authority for the police officer to do what he did. That is, there are sources of authority in common law that would justify what occurred here. Would you agree?
Yes.
All right. For us, the question is where doctrinally this police conduct fits. That is, how do we justify it doctrinally? I think you're arguing, but I'm not sure, that the conduct is justified under the community caretaker, if that's the right phrase, doctrine.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. And the argument that you have to confront is that while there's no dispute that doctrine would allow some type of intervention by the police, that it was a limited type of intervention, and once the defendant here told the policeman that he was not in need of any help, then there was no further authority under that doctrine for the policeman to ask the 1902 type questions.
What?
Right? That is the argument you're being confronted with.
Right.
Your argument appears to be no. There's a broader scope to what is permissible under the community caretaker doctrine. I think that's your argument.
I am, and my argument is that what the appellant wants to say is, as soon as the guy says, I'm okay, I'm going to continue to walk on, that basically all of the police officer's concerns as a community caretaker should have simply evaporated and he should have been done.
Okay, and you're giving us real-world factual type arguments as to why that should be so. My question is there any authority that supports what that expanded view, and I'll use those words in quotes, of what can be asked when the policeman is functioning as a community caretaker?
I have to say no, but, and the no is I can't think of a specific case that says, in the community care doctrine, you get to ask him their name or anything like that. It's not a 1902 type thing.
There are no cases that you cited.
No. However, when you look to the law review articles that discuss community caretaker, the problem is everybody's all over the board. And the problem is this, and none of them specifically say, this is what you get to ask.
Is it fair to say that we have a question of first impression?
As to the community care doctrine and how it works doctrinally in Delaware, I would suggest yes.
Are we talking about an issue of state law or as Justice Berger asked, federal law or both?
I believe if we are talking, one, as I suggest respectfully, that the state statute does not apply in this right. particular case. Two, it's only been raised under the federal constitution, and therefore I think that at least Caddy in those cases and some of the federal cases are helpful there. It has not been raised under the state constitution. It has not been fairly presented to this court. I'd suggest it hasn't been fairly presented to the court below. This court has said in Ortiz.
So your answer is that we're talking about a federal constitutional question here.
Yes.
Well, let's factor the community caretaker doctrine out of this. Let's assume hypothetically the person's walking in the same place except it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the policeman goes over and says, you know, just stops them and says, what's your name? What's your age? As I understand the state's position, the police officer could stop and do that even if there were no concerns about the person's health or well-being. And if the person gave their name and age, that might turn out to be to their detriment for Mr. Williams, because they would, you know, check and find out they were capious. And if the person wanted to just keep walking, they could do that too.
Yes. I'd suggest that that's what Royer says in Bostick. That's what this court has said in Ross. I believe it said it again in Meads, even though we didn't get to that ultimate issue. I mean, certainly the court, again, adopted its Ross analysis, saying, look, not every encounter is a seizure.
All right. So that, well, and we've said that recently. So if we assume as a general proposition, for no reason, the policeman can just be walking down the sidewalk, pick anybody they want and say, hi, what's your name, what's your age, and they answer, and that's fine if the person wants to answer or walk on. How does the introduction of the community caretaker into the equation change the court's analysis?
Well, the only benefit of the community care doctrine is that perhaps it's a little more factually applicable in this case than the circumstance, the hypothetical that Your Honor raises.
Well, it seems I don't know that it adds a great deal. Reason to talk to the person. You know, if they're obviously injured on the sidewalk, you'd say to them, "Are you?" Or if they're sitting on the sidewalk, you would say, "Are you okay? What's your name? What's your age?" And then we say, they didn't pick the person at random to say, who are you, what's your name, what's your age. They picked them because as a community caretaker, you talk to people who are sitting or lying on the sidewalk.
Sure, and I believe that's what courts look to. I mean, look, obviously in the community care doctrine, there is discussion of the concern of pretext. And so community care doctrine helps the courts in understanding that when there are objective factors out there, such as we have in this case, that explain why the police officer would undertake this public servant duty instead of simply seeing a guy at 3 o'clock in the morning and thinking he's shady and stopping him.
All right, so then we come back to, in discharging that responsibility, why did they need to know his name and age?
I think I would suggest respectfully that, one, it ensures, I'm sure there's many things going through a police officer's mind, but one of the things that it does ensure as an objective matter in this case is that the police officer fully discharged it, realized this is an adult, for instance. I mean, this was a 21-year-old. We don't know what he looked like as far as youthfulness or non-youthfulness, but asking him his name and his age and ensuring, okay, he's Jordan Williams, he's 21, that could be part of it, but also to... And why then move on to validate that information?
So you seem to be suggesting it's like carding someone, and, you know, if they don't look to be 21, you say, can I have some identification? And here, he might have thought, hypothetically, that the person was a juvenile runaway. So you get the name and age ostensibly to check to see if they're a juvenile runaway. And in this case, you find out, nope, it's an adult fugitive.
That certainly can be part of it. That the state suggests that if the police officer is in that second mode of community caretaker, that it simply makes sense to at least ensure, because he is an officer of the law, he may also be subjected later on to questions about his activity. If he went back to the station.
Is there evidence in the record about an administrative responsibility to get the defendant's name in this case?
Only in the quote that I gave the court from the record, that seemed to be the only place where it was really discussed, where he was asked on cross-examination, why did you do this? And he explained that, you know, something we usually do. I don't know that I cannot tell the court in the record that he specifically said, because we do a form, you know, 472 of, you know, a pedestrian stop or something like that. But the reality is if, in fact, he didn't do that, and if, in fact, the worst happened, and the worst could be many things, he would be greatly questioned that he talked to somebody at 3:50 in the morning and never even got their name or age. If he was a juvenile, if he was anything else, if he ended up dead. What if Jordan Williams came back and sued him and brought a 1983 action, said, I got a, you know, this Fourth Amendment violation, cops are stopping me in the middle of the road, and he never even got his name? Then he's a police officer trying to explain that. There are many unfortunate issues that police officers have to deal with in that short amount of time.
Let me get back to something that maybe is not technically before us now, but I think has been danced around here. There's a real concern with the fact that a name and age, date of birth, residence, some other tying in identification information opens up a wealth of possibilities. Granted, it also deals with all the concerns you were just expressing about a police officer carrying out his responsibilities, but from a real-world perspective, the concern is if average Joe citizen can be asked by the police to give name and other identifying information, then the police can do an awful lot with that and find out everything about what this person's been up to and potentially follow up and pursue that person. And there seems to be some understanding that not every contact with the police is a seizure. Why can't the police just go up and say, hi, I'm Officer so-and-so, what's your name? But underlying all of that is the idea that people don't have to answer. And what I'm asking is, from the state's perspective, is that a valid hypothesis that people don't have to answer the police? Unless we talk about a situation where an officer comes up to you and says, I'm Officer so-and-so, I'd like to ask you your name and other things about yourself. You don't have to answer me, but, you know, would you tell me your name? That's a whole different ball of wax. But in terms of the concept of being seized, feeling free to leave, is there a second component to it, which is not so much whether you can keep walking, but the fact that almost everybody, if a police officer walks up to them and says, I'm a police officer, what's your name, what's your address, most every human being thinks that they have to answer that question?
I guess the problem then is, Your Honor, that we're raised correctly, that we're either polite and don't just turn on our heels away from somebody, or that we respect a certain level of authority that the police have shown or do show. But the flip side of that, and the reality is in under the law, they are free to leave. And as long as it's not shown by some other manifestation, merely that he's a police officer asking this question, the state suggests it doesn't rise to a Fourth Amendment issue. But the reality then is this. If we don't give the police officers this ability, then the whole idea of what the communities want out of our police is for naught. Because they become these uniformed strangers in our neighborhood that nobody can talk to, or they can talk to no one, unless they have suspicion to believe that they are involved in crime. The bottom line is this. Officer Brittingham did what was right in this case. He saw somebody he thought was in the need of assistance, and he stopped to help him. And at the end of it, he ensured that he followed up on what they usually do and asked him his name and his age.
That is not the source of what they usually do. I think Justice Risley's asked, twice that question. Is there some regulation of his police department that says when you stop someone under these circumstances, you are to do X, Y, or Z, whether it's for your own protection, for the department's protection, for the protection of the individual? Was there some administrative regulation or protocol that he was following?
It is not in that formal sense. There's nothing in the record that there was that. There is his own testimony that I had quoted earlier, and it's found at A9 of the appendix of
appellant. Does it make any difference that there is or isn't, or that the record doesn't reflect either way?
I suggest no. I suggest that there shouldn't be. If we try to regulate every question that a police officer can ask, what we are going to do is have this actual soul-killing system that simply doesn't allow police officers to do anything outside of merely arresting people. And that's not what they're always all about.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.